Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. Hi everyone! Thanks for joining us on another episode of the Treasures from Malta podcast. Today's guest should fire you up with enthusiasm for the arts. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce the wonderful Bernie Mizzi.
Hi, Fran. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to our chat.
Bernie, your entire career since graduating from university has been focused on the educational sector. On graduation, you returned to Chiswick House School, which was your childhood school, and you returned to teach, rising through the ranks and becoming principal and later co-head and director. Chiswick flourished. It expanded its operations, and you went on to set up St. Martin's College, which catered for secondary school students and sixth formers, essentially providing a smooth passage for students from kindergarten to pre-university, therefore covering the first 18 years of a student's life. In all of this, you have injected the arts as a major element in the curriculum. Bernie, do the arts elevate us? Do they actually make us better human beings?
Absolutely. At least they work for me. Let me just say this. The arts are there, in my opinion, in my very humble opinion. They are there to refine our soul, to refine our existence, and to give us that really wonderful sense of awe, which is so important when we're living a happy life. I mean, this is how I add joy to my life in many, many ways. Mm-hmm. And I think for many people, this also works. Some people have discovered the arts. Some people wouldn't live without them for a single minute. I think it happens. It happens to affect you as much as you are ready to let the arts in.
How about elevating us? I mean, they are teaching us. They are revealing truths that perhaps are not that evident or cannot be said, but by means of the arts, in a way, there is a reflection of life that makes us just actually open our eyes to what is going on around us.
Absolutely. And I like to see it as an opportunity to come to terms with your own style. Because after all, who are we and what are we? Mm-hmm. We are what we eat, we are what we see, what we experience. And I think the arts, as I said earlier, just refines that wonderful experience. It elevates also towards a really higher order of thinking and feeling. At least that's how I feel. Mm-hmm. For example, if we take the idea, I believe it was Keats who said, we are in a veil of soul making. If we are, you know, creating ourselves, if we are, like many psychologists say today, self-actualizing ourselves, who are we? What's our potential? Mm-hmm. How can we get to the best that we can be? I believe the arts just do this so beautifully and so gracefully. Mm-hmm. And when you're connected to any of the arts, whether it's through music or through dance or literature or poetry or film, or any type of or architecture, any art form is going to give you and find in you a very special space, which is going to make you feel better, is going to make you feel more connected to others, and is going to make you feel a better version of yourself. At least that is my experience.
Bernie, where did you grow up and were you exposed to the arts as a child?
Oh, yes, very much. I was very lucky. I was born into a family of a bohemian mother, very unconventional mother. and a very stoic and solid father, who both, they both loved the arts incredibly. My mother was a trained literature and history teacher, so she was totally connected to her subject matter, but also did it definitely for pleasure. And my father, being an architect, but a scientist, but also in his time, you can imagine, he was one of four in the architectural course at university. They had a program that saw them getting a very rounded education. Mm-hmm. So he was as good in literature and the languages as he was in sciences. Mm-hmm. And obviously, because he was an architect, design and shape and form, was very much part of his psyche. We had a household where we had some very happy experiences and, like everybody, had some very sad ones. But I believe the thing that I look back on all the time is how we always had music in the house. Someone, somewhere was playing music, whether it was my father whistling Bach or my mother playing her records or this, or my brother Stephen playing on the piano. And my twin brother Martin, who unfortunately died at a very young age of 20, and also was good at playing the guitar. So, and I took ballet lessons. So music somehow was always there. But apart from that, I think one of the things that really, shall I say, pushed me towards the visual arts were two things. Firstly, I think now I know I'm a very visual learner. So for me, if you want to sort of connect to me, if you put an image, I'm going to understand it far better than if you just talk to me about something for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. Okay. So although I can listen to a lecture for 3 hours, I still would prefer, I think, a visual representation, an infographic of what's happening. Mm-hmm. And also, my uncle, Carmelo Manjon, is a Maltese artist, was a Maltese artist, and I visited their home quite regularly. Mm-hmm. So I was very, very lucky in that, you know, he would take us for drives and then he'd stop us off at home and then go into his studio and not come out. And I would say, you know, age 3, 4, 5, where is he? What's he doing? And he would take me into his, you know, studio, and I was, you know, totally in awe of all of that. So yes, my brother's also artistic, and now with my nephew, Mark Manjon, is also a contemporary artist. So I've always had a little bit of art in my life, let me say that, and seeing it and feeling it.
You've actually transposed it into your profession as well. Your Chiswick is well known for the art content of the curriculum. What changes did you actually bring in at Chiswick that increased the content of the arts in the school curriculum?
Okay, so first of all, let me just start off. I joined a very established school. It was very small. Chiswick was small at the time when I joined in 81, but it had a wonderful tradition. It had a wonderful tradition because my mother really made sure that the arts were included. But this comes from a long time before my mother. Chiswick was founded in 1905, and the two women really made sure that they were reading up a lot about the Montessoris of their time, even later, and also always had a very strong arts curriculum. Mm-hmm. So really and truly, I dipped into the collective memory. Mm-hmm. I dipped into the traditions that were already there. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to play a musical instrument. Everybody had to learn art. And everybody had to be good at literature. It was just a sine qua non, you know. That was Chiswick. Chiswick had a very strong presence of the arts, and it was given a lot of space. I still remember being a very young, I would say 7-year-old, where we were told not only that we were going to be presenting at a concert, but that we had to come up with our own script for the Water Babies, for example, or for something else. So it was always there. In fact, we have a wonderful certificate from 1947 when Chiswick students, Chiswick children had won a Manuel Theatre competition for the Kneeling Queen. What that was, we don't know, but we have the certificate.
Perhaps the archives will reveal one day. Do you have archives at Chiswick, actually, that record all these, but first of all, the curriculum at the time, and also sort of the achievements of the school, even in the arts?
Yes, but we still have to put it together. I remember when we celebrated our 100th anniversary in 2005, we had started pulling together everything we had. We have lovely letters that go back to 1911, 1922, 1947, 1950s, beautiful letters by people at the time. People would write you a beautiful letter when the children left the school. So we have people from all over the world, and a lot of Maltese families too, had started joining the ranks of Chiswick. Mm-hmm. At first it was seen as a British school, opened for the families of British naval officers stationed in Malta, but then many Maltese did start to choose Chiswick as their, at least as their kindergarten, as their first stepping stone in education. And we have wonderful records of Maltese families joining the school. We have some archives. It's going to be, I think, a retirement project where I get the students also together to put it together, because I believe very much in today having real life experiences for the kids. It's great to talk about history, but if you say, okay, kids, we've got this, you know, all this material, all these archives, how on earth do we make them visible and realistic and enjoyable to the people who might want to read it?
Yeah, so what you need is a historian and then somebody to actually interpret it for the public and to bring it all alive. It sounds like the Chiswick historian has his or her work cut out for her. But talking about involvement and being hands-on, one of your rather brave ideas was to organize art trips overseas for St. Martin's students. So essentially we're talking about a bunch of teenagers being taken abroad on a jolly, but the jolly had a purpose, of course. Tell me about these trips.
Absolutely. So let me just say this. First of all, I was also very lucky. Not only did we have the history and a curriculum that was very exciting already, but obviously we did add lots of things to it. But when I joined Chiswick in 1981, I found, again, some wonderful women, Marguerite Manjon, my sister-in-law, who sadly has passed away, but also Madeleine Vassallo, Vicky Tabone, Christina Giustcesario. All these people were so fired up themselves about making sure that we kept what was good and that with the next generation, so it was Marguerite and then me continuing with all the wonderful teachers, and we had to make sure that we kept it going. So we did dip into what happened in the past, but we started new initiatives. And one of the first initiatives that Marguerite had started was to make sure that we traveled with the kids abroad. And she wanted exchanges. She wanted to make sure that we could exchange some ideas with other schools. And she started that. And then, very closely after that, I started thinking of, but what if we were to look at the, you know, art trips and drama trips? This was very much later, and this was done with a very good friend of mine and somebody who's a senior leader at Chiswick and St. Martin's at the moment, Marika Portelli. And we were, I remember this very clearly, we're at the Louvre together, and we were going around, and we see all these children at the Louvre, everywhere, children enjoying the arts. And we just looked at each other. I said, you know, Marika, these children have such an advantage over our children. We don't have this for them. We have our own museums in Malta, of course. We do take them everywhere, of course, in Malta. But they don't have this. And this at such a high level. And therefore, we started the art trips and the drama trips. Both have been extremely popular with our children. The drama trip is a trip which is organized by Marika, but also by Kurt Cheney, a great drama teacher at our school, where these kids actually get first-hand experience. They go to Pineapple Studios in the morning. They get, you know, they get a lot of wonderful experiences from the best people, you know, on West End. And then in the evening, they actually see them on stage. So this just, I mean, fires their imagination, I need to tell you. The art trips, on the other hand, were art trips that we put together through the art department at St. Martin's, so middle school, secondary, and then also sixth form students. So the art department, again, extremely inspirational, with people like Victor and Bertrand Bonici and Mario Borch and Natalie, I mean, a buzz that you've never seen. Who actually said, okay, we're taking them to Paris. Okay, we're taking them to Amsterdam. We've been to Florence three times, you know. So every single year we would dream up another destination. And the kids, sometimes the same ones, sometimes different ones, would fill up, you know, our numbers. Very difficult to control in the sense, you know, it's an enormous, enormous responsibility. And I can tell you that at our last drama trip, we had quite a lot of drama outside the drama studio. So, you know, today, obviously, sadly, all these trips have stopped, but we are, of course, ready to go to start them up again.
You must be referring to 2017, when there were the London attacks, and you had a group of children with you in London, a group of students. How close were you and how on earth did you manage to control and to keep calm and to keep them safe?
Yes, actually, I wasn't on the trip with them, but Marika and Kurt were. It was a drama trip and they were, you know, doing extremely well. But obviously, things started getting rather shaky. Before we even left, you know, we had really good discussions with the parents. We spoke about how safely we were going to be working, etc., with the children. And don't forget, the children do, you know, quite a lot of walking to and fro. And on one of the attacks, we were literally about 20 minutes, 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. And that really, really worried us. And so we put them, obviously, into the residential area that we were in. We had to modify how we went to the studios and how we went to the theaters. And we also cancelled a few things here and there, because if we weren't sure about the safety of our children, we were going to take them nowhere. Obviously, we came back very safely, very soundly. There were absolutely no difficulties at all, but it did shake us.
Bernie, let me pull you away from hands-on teaching and actual contact with students to talk more about the policy level. You have advised on education on a national and EU level, and you've sat on the council of the University of Malta. You even went on to become pro-chancellor at the university between 2010 and 2013. If you had the magical power of effecting radical reform on a national level, so we're talking Malta-wide, in the arts, in the educational sector, of course, what would be the first three things you would do?
Okay, first of all, the first thing I would do would look into teacher education, how teachers are actually educated to be teachers. I mean, we have a great program in two different institutions, the University of Malta and also the Institute for Education. I mean, everybody does their bit to give us wonderful teachers. And we really do have some wonderful teachers in this country. And I salute them today like never before for having been through such a difficult year. The whole of the world is looking at teachers at the moment and saying, you know, a lovely big thank you. But I think we need to do far more in how we grow their minds, their hearts, their souls. And I think we need to do a lot more in giving them the opportunity, because we have wonderful people who want to be teachers, but we must have a great campaign to bring in the best minds and the best hearts into the profession. And I would say that the first thing I would probably do is a big campaign to get all the best people into education. And then once I've got them there, then I would want to see that how we nurture their love for the profession is a way in which we give them a lot of space to be creative themselves. Because I honestly believe that unless we allow them to make some mistakes to be creative themselves, how on earth can they even identify creativity? How can they give space for it if they themselves haven't experienced it in a wonderful way?
Would exposure to the arts encourage creativity? Let's say a maths teacher or a science teacher, should we have this crossover?
Absolutely. First of all, we all know that in the pinnacle of knowledge, you know, arts and sciences come together. There is no such thing as division. Let us be very, very clear. Even the greatest artists, the greatest scientists have always had, shall we say, wonderful connections with all aspects of learning, with all aspects of knowledge. For example, I remember very, very clearly as an A-level student being, you know, blown away by Aristotle and aesthetics and all these. I had no idea about how all this came together in planning, in designing, in being even. How do you, you know, get to being the best you can be? So I think there we must give them more space and we must give them more experiences to be able to feel it. Because if they feel it, they can pick it up in the classroom and give a lot of space to our wonderful kids. Having said that, there are some very creative teachers in this country. Sometimes, sadly, we don't know about them. And their stories aren't often said. And that's probably another thing I would do. I would really make sure that there are many, many initiatives for innovators. I think often the system, our system, doesn't give us the opportunity to identify great talent early, give them a faster path to where they want to be. And I think this is something that is going to be really important, not only for arts education, but it's going to be very important for our country. There's a wonderful seminal book called The Fourth Revolution. It is written by two journalists, I believe, Michael Lethwaite and Wooldridge. And they actually started this idea about how in many countries, democracies are having a very hard time. They started talking way back in 2014 and even before that about how many of our systems are falling apart. And their bottom line was very, very clear. The countries that are going to be giving a lot of time and space to their innovators, to their creators, to the creative side of people, those are the ones who are going to do best of all. Mm-hmm. And therefore, how real is this? This is real in education. This is real in the arts. This is real in every single sphere of our country. And I think it is the youth, and as we were saying, Fran, the women, many women, who are going to come forward and who are going to be giving this great energy, this great push to getting the best we can out of the wonderful people who make up Malta.
So I'm going to push you for your third point. So we're talking about reforms in the educational sector. Have you had the power to actually affect on a nationwide level? We've talked about uplifting the teachers and identifying the people who should become teachers because they think with their heart, but also with their mind. We need to prize the innovators and encourage them and support them. What would your third reform be?
I think today more than ever before to support the artists and also to conserve, preserve and visualize like Patrimonio does so beautifully, our Malteseness, our culture, everything that really makes us Maltese. Sometimes in conversations, some people say, but where is our Maltese identity? What would you cite as the Maltese identity? Of course we have a Maltese identity. Of course we have beautiful ways in our cultures. We have beautiful artifacts that are Maltese, and these are the things that we have to look after and make visible and make known. And I think that would be my third push, as we talk, sort of going in different directions, as we talk about our kids being more and more globally minded, when we talk about global perspectives. When you talk about global perspectives, your national, your identity becomes 100 million times more important than ever before. Because if you don't have that in your nation, in your country, if you don't have that in the hearts and minds and the essences of your population, how on earth can you appreciate what there is in other countries? How can you be a global worker or a global thinker or a global person if you cannot even start or know your own little spot?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is the whole point of Patrimonio. We really shine a light on our heritage, our mixed heritage, because really we are a melting pot of Europe and North Africa ultimately. It's really a wonderful bringing together of many cultures, and somehow this potpourri of all these cultures becomes uniquely Maltese. We give it this stamp, which is Maltese. And we try and identify and showcase this through our exhibitions and publications. Our historians as well are doing a magnificent job on discovering more and more about our past, shattering preconceived ideas, things like, for example, Dr. Joan Abella, who has worked a lot on women's history and on identifying what the economy was like in between the arrival of the knights and the siege. Areas and so many other historians who have brought this knowledge to the fore. The problem always seems to be that it stops there. They publish, they do deliver a number of lectures, but it's always the same group of people who attend these lectures, who come to the exhibitions. How do we reach out to a larger group of people, to the entire nation? There are programs, of course, there are cultural programs on radio, on TV, even this podcast is a new way of reaching out to even more people. But it never seems to be enough. How do you break through and really interest people in culture?
Okay, how I wish I had all the answers. I don't. Far from it. But I've learned from so many wonderful people around me. And when I speak to many professors at the university, but also when I speak to my friends and people I socialize with, a lot of the times, I think it's a lot about communication. So how do we communicate? And again, start with the young. If children in Malta, across all our sectors, the state, the church, the independent sector, if all of our students are used to being roped into history projects, roped into environmental projects, roped into art projects, if we have many of these children experiencing the beauty and the joy of this and the excitement of discovering and finding something new, then that is going to continue into their middle age and their old age and everywhere. And they will support the arts and they will engage in the arts. Let me say this. When I was, I like to continue teaching. And there was a while where I spent, I think, about 15 years teaching active citizenship and film studies. And it was very, very important for me to bring across this idea and to get the children to feel the urgency of it. And I would say, listen, an active citizen needs to partake in culture. Because if we don't, we are not regenerating that culture, we are not protecting it, and we're not growing it. And we're not doing our bit towards it. So you can choose how to do it. You can just go and just be part of it, if you like, and sit there and enjoy it. Or you can be on the stage and do it. But whatever it is, we need to be able to be out there and be part of it. Because sadly, we might sit in front of a television set and see it like that, but we don't get active enough. And that is why I call the program Active Citizenship. And that is how the film projects came about, only because the students themselves were so engaged. And I wanted to connect citizenship with literature. I wanted to connect citizenship with the arts.
Let's talk about it then. As media studies teacher at Form 5 level, you got your 16-year-old students to produce short films. You've given us a little indication of that. But they are based on Shakespearean text with very original twists. Firstly, why Shakespeare? And secondly, do students get involved in all aspects of production? I mean, from script writing to prop making, costume making, filming, direction, editing even?
Okay, so let me tell you how it started. It's quite interesting. I was head of school at St. Martin's, and our media teacher walked out, and two of us, Miss Anita and myself, had to go in and cover the lessons until June. That's all there was. I mean, of course, I was not a media teacher. But we had, as it is in many, many countries abroad, media studies and literature work hand in hand very, very closely. So obviously, I went to all my wonderful English teachers, literature teachers, and said, okay, guys, you've got to help me. We've got to do something together because, you know, this is how it's got to work out till June. And we started discussing, and we started this program of active citizenship and cultural studies. Our school is one of the, St. Martin's, is one of the only schools in Malta that has literature as compulsory. And that will never change. Why? Because, first of all, we believe that English literature and Maltese literature and German literature and all the literature in the world is an essential part of language learning. How on earth can you learn a language if you don't feel the best bits that are written, you know, by their authors, etc.? So that's number one. Why Shakespeare? Shakespeare is the universal man of all times. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, voted in as the mind, the person, the dramatist, who has spoken so much about the human soul, the human spirit. And therefore, how can you not do Shakespeare with young people? Now, at first, as you can imagine, some kids, especially the kids who are very good at literature and can write a wonderful literary piece, almost, those find it very easy to find those connections. But I always wanted to make sure that I connected those students who had actually had decided that they were not going to do the literature exam. So we everybody learns literature, but not everybody has to sit for the exam. Some people, you know, some kids are very good at writing essays and at deconstructing texts, and some are not. But I still wanted to give those other students the experience. And those students, some of them, were the most creative. Those were the ones who were working on props, who were doing, you know, working with editing, working with costume, working with ideas. Don't forget, 16-year-old kids love to dress up. You should see the girls. Okay. No matter in which, in which era we set Romeo and Juliet or Macbeth, whichever it was, whether it was the 70s or the 1400s or the 1500s or wherever, or even the future, the girls were there wanting to dress up, wanting to wear costumes. The boys wanted to have fun, learn new skills. For example, one time we told them how to use swords, obviously safely, but they had a duel and they had to do it, you know, convincingly on set. And it was great. These kids, you know, are very fired by it. And every single year, we've done it now for many years, and we've roped in everybody. And now, sadly, I no longer teach active citizenship and cultural studies, but we have an excellent teacher called Frederick, who has also now developed media studies. And in fact, I helped, you know, the university, the MATSEC board, to develop media studies for everybody in Malta. Now it's a vocational subject. So, you know, these kids just see Shakespeare in a different way. And funnily enough, a lot of people say, but that language, do they really connect with that language? First of all, the literature teachers do their bit in the classroom, and they deconstruct the text in a beautiful way. But then we construct in the children's minds their idea of the play, of the themes, of what was happening in the Middle Ages and after, and the Reformation. And there, kids start making connections. And they start saying, miss, this bit about leadership is as important as it was then as it is now. Absolutely. So we don't just leave it as Macbeth and Banquo and, you know, Duncan. We say, okay, that was leadership then. Why was it such a terrible act that he was killing his king? Because at the time, the king was sent from God, etc., etc. What about today? What is leadership today? So we make it as real as we possibly can. And we let the students decide at which era they want to set it in. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, we did a lot of the stuff ourselves as adults. But as the kids got more and more engaged and excited about it, and I was very lucky to work with some of the best people in film in Malta, I mean, incredible stuff. One of them, in fact, I wanted to say this, you're going to ask me, I think, is one of our own students who was, you know, who took part in one of our first films, actually went on to work in film, which is absolutely great. So, yes, the kids love it, and I do it purposely. We still have it every single year in Level 11. Level 11 is a year of great stress because of the exams, and I always believe that if you're stressed out, do something creative. And these kids, you know, take part in this film as a creative catharsis sort of experience where, you know, they can stop thinking about their books and their studying, and they can just come out and be, you know, a part, play a part, do their bit. So some people are just looking after the food, some people just do the logistics, and others are just watching them, you know, or some of them are taking part.
But still, the excitement of being on a film set and of seeing it all come together in a joint project. But speaking about excitement, enjoyment, how the arts reflects everyday life as well and are relevant even in contemporary times, I think this is a good time to take a break so we can let it all sink in, and we'll be back soon. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, Bernie Mizzi, who has contributed much to the educational sector in Malta. And we're back. I'll remind you that pictures and links are on the podcast section at www.patrimonio.org. And don't forget to give us a follow on the Treasures from Malta podcast pages on Facebook and Instagram. Back to film studies and this wonderful project that you had initiated some years ago. One of the films was particularly well received. It was the 2010 film Blood Will Have Blood, which was produced by your media studies students, and it won acclaim overseas. Run us through the making of the film and to what extent it was recognized abroad.
Okay, so first of all, this was a very interesting year. It was a year where we had a lot of students who were very, very into the arts, but also into their literature. And one time, I remember, I went into the classroom and I said, okay, let's try a really interesting project this year. I knew I could do it because there were some really good people. And I said, okay, let's try and link the two books you are studying. And one of them was Macbeth and the other was Animal Farm. And the kids looked at me and said, you know, Ms. Bernie, are you sure? I mean, how on earth are we going to do this? And I said nothing. And I said, okay, let's just try. And I said nothing. It was the end of, I remember, the first term, and we came back in January. And we always film around March. So by January, we have to get serious. And in January, this boy piped up, his name was Zach, and he said, Ms. Bernie, I know what we can do. We can link them. I said, yeah, how? And he said, we can link the last scene in Animal Farm with the banquet scene in Macbeth. And I was like, okay, so I went home and I started, you know, looking it up. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we put it together. I wrote the script, and we had lots of people giving suggestions as how the script could be improved. We worked a lot with the kids on the script, and we had to find a place. Where are we going to film something like this? It was very, very out there, you know, it was very unconventional. The purists didn't like the idea at all. How on earth would you connect, you know, Shakespeare to Animal Farm? And therefore it was quite demanding. Mm-hmm. But we found a place for it. We went to a very outlandish place to film, and we put it together, and the children were amazing. We had really good actors and actresses. Mm-hmm. We had a really good film crew. We, you know, sometimes it just happens, you know, yeah. And all the magic comes together and it works.
Were they mentored by actual directors and people who are professionals?
Yes, absolutely. Many professionals, Matthew Policino, David Serge. These are some of the best names on the island for this sort of stuff, and others too. But they, you know, they really, as they always did every year, because I worked with them for many years, put their heart and soul into it. And, you know, these are the people who were sort of practicing with us, because they, in the beginning, they were a very, very new company, but they practiced with us, but they really gave it their best. And these are very creative people. And therefore, we got, you know, the best out of everybody, I would say. And when I saw, you know, the final cut, I said, this one is good. You know how it is, you know, some are better than others. And so at the time, there was a call. The Royal Shakespeare Company were asking for examples of good practice of teaching literature and working with the kids. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, I went to the English department, everybody, I said, listen, let's just apply. I mean, what can happen? They'll say no. Mm-hmm. So we applied, we sent, you know, I think at first it was quite a rough cut. And they came back and said, listen, you know, you're, as usual, last minute, but yes, come. And we said, come. And they said, yeah, come to the Tate. We're hosting all these educators from around the world, you know, people from Australia, everywhere, talking about how Shakespeare is active and alive in the classroom. And we, in fact, we called it, you know, Shakespeare Alive, and we went up with this production. And also, obviously, I had to talk about the educational aspects of how we put it together. And so that was, for us, our highlight. We got recognized by the Royal Shakespeare Company. We got recognized by a lot of the educational, the teachers, really, and head teachers of other schools in other countries. And we made some really good connections, even in New York and other places, to keep the conversation going. So that was fun.
So, Bernie, we've talked a lot about the visual arts, but I know that you were also involved in other art forms. What about the performing arts?
Yes, of course. So very much apart from the film, it's films themselves. We have the School of Performing Arts, which we run as an extracurricular program, which has been around for many, many years. It was one of Marguerite Mangin's dreams to see this happening after school hours. And we don't only open it to our own kids, we open it up to kids from all over Malta. And this is such a wonderful experience, because the kids can come together from different schools, from different sectors, and perform together, which is lovely. So we have dance, we have music, we have individual singing lessons, we have drama, lovely performances being done over the years. And as I mentioned earlier, I think I did mention them, you know, one time it was The Lion, Witch and the Wardrobe at the MCC, and another time it was The West Side Story at the Manuel Theatre, and quite recently also in the wonderful new theatre in Valletta, we had a really good performance from the troupe. So run by wonderful people like Kathy Loa and Lorana Aquilina and her daughter Francesca, and many, many others like Denise Mulholland, who do such a great job with the kids.
But Bernie, you're not only about education and the arts, you've also gone beyond that. And in 2013, you set up a foundation, the Storm Petrel Foundation. What is its purpose and why on earth did you name it after a bird?
Okay, so why did I do this? Well, first of all, I wanted to do something that probably I could go to after I retired.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was an important part of it. Apart from that, I had a lot of friends of mine, very like-minded, who, from the University of Malta, were very interested in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, a little bit of a tribute to my parents, to my brother, to many, many people I know. And I wanted to make sure that we got together and put together a foundation, and it's a public foundation, to really promote art, literature, and popular culture. Now, popular culture at the time, there were not many outlets where popular culture would be given a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very important for us. So things like film posters, comics, things like that. We wanted a place. Also because we were, shall we say, very connected to collectors.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm absolutely fascinated by collectors,
mm-hmm,
and what they collect. And this comes from a long, long time ago. This comes from my childhood. As I said to you, I was very lucky. I had very many inspirational people around me, apart from my family members, also my family's friends, and also my friends' fathers. One of my best friends still is Rita Garrado, Rita Navzamut.
Of course.
And her father, obviously, is one of Malta's most famous collectors, Albert Garrado. And I still remember really, really clearly, and this is, you know, how children get, get impressionable and are impressionable. When we would be at her house, this beautiful Valletta house, and, you know, her father would join us for dinner, join us for breakfast and lunch. And I used to spend a lot of time at their house and she'd spend time at mine. But he'd always be behind closed doors doing something. And one time I said, you know, to Rita, I said, but Rita, what on earth is he doing? You know, why does he go into his study all the time? I know he's a lawyer, but I mean, you know, is that much work? And she said, Bernie, he's a collector. He collects maps. He collects Melitensia. And I still remember, honestly, it was like a very special experience. Walking into this room and seeing him on this desk, covered in papers and books and things around him. This room was like something I've never seen before. And, oh my God, what is this? And he'd take us around very patiently, explaining about his stamps, about his you know, times of Malta from the first, you know, right to the last, you know, and whatever. And the maps and the books and everything. So I remember that feeling. And in fact, when we opened the foundation, I talked about this feeling because, mm-hmm, I think it really got me connected to these people who have a dream within a dream and a world within a world. They go, mm-hmm, to their own worlds, their own spaces, which they love.
Yes.
It helps them deal with life, I suppose, and it just lets them do what they love to do most. And Malta has many, many collectors, as you very well know, from Patrimonio.
Yes. Patrimonio obviously connects very well with collectors because we loan objects for our exhibitions from private collectors mostly, but also from the state and from the church. The other thing about collectors is that they are preserving our heritage. They are perhaps recognizing it before even our institutions do, especially in the past. And they were buying up, preserving these objects, you know, ensuring them, keeping them in a good state. Ultimately, they are enriching and really, really preserving for future generations these wonderful heritage that we have around us. You mentioned popular culture, and this is another element of that collectors will collect, even if other people don't believe that the objects that they are being collected are necessarily valuable in terms of art or in terms of monetary value, but they can recognize that that these objects have value in terms of history, in terms of preserving traditions, and they will collect them nonetheless. And thank God for that. Ultimately, when people like us organize exhibitions, we go knocking on their doors and we do find objects that we can bring to the public. And the public is fascinated to learn about these objects. So it works out well. We really need to prize our collectors. They need tax breaks. They should be, in some way, they should be helped as much as possible to continue with, you know, creating their little private museums.
Absolutely. And this is what we wanted to preserve, because we know for a fact that there are many, many collectors who would want to donate it's a donation that they'd have to do. They would want to donate their collection to the Storm Petrel Foundation because they would have spent a lifetime collecting. Now, some people might say, but shouldn't they give it to their children? Shouldn't they give it to their, you know, some people, of course, do that, and rightly so, of course.
That's the best choice.
It's their choice, but some children are not interested in their parents' collection, and some people are unmarried and have collections and don't want to leave them to nephews or nieces and don't want to leave them to anybody else. So we said, what if we set up a foundation which is very legally regularized and everything above board and whatever, in a way that would encourage those collectors, irrespective of how big or how grand their collection is, to donate them to us, and we would put together a cell. It's called a cell. This is something that came from Professor Max Granado, who gave us a really good structure where the cell would belong to the collector. Sort of they are loaning it to the foundation for us to use for exhibitions, for us to use forever. And if anything happens to the foundation, one way or another, it would either go back or it would go to another place where the wishes of the collector would be safeguarded. So they're safe with their collection. Don't forget, sometimes collectors would give part of their collection to a museum, part of their collection to their children. So there's a very mixed bag of how you can do this. We decided to actually hone in on art, literature, and popular culture, because we felt, first of all, the trustees are people who are very much connected to these areas. Okay, so we have Professor Gloria Lauri Lucente, we have Professor Van Kalluz, we have Professor Xavier Catania, we have youngsters now coming in. We're very excited. We've got younger trustees coming in like Justine and Kenneth Chikula. So we have this young blood coming in as well who can continue with the work that we start off. Obviously, we have already been told that we have some really good collections that will come to us when the collectors pass away. Obviously, and we are in duty bound to look after those collections.
Are you set up to be able to store these objects, to catalogue, to publish them?
Yes, but we're just starting. As you can imagine, I mean, we're just starting to be able to take on the bulk. But we have had already three very successful exhibitions. One was our opening exhibition, which was wonderful. It was Oscar Wilde, the life of Oscar Wilde, and we have great collectors in Malta, and one in particular has been absolutely blew us away with his artifacts. And also we had two others that related to popular culture where we put up, it was called The Other Side, and it was sort of horror literature in texts, in film posters and also in comics, yes. and obviously yes. other printed material. It was very well received, but obviously very well received by a lot of very young people, and also not so young people, but people who are interested in either film or the horror genre, the comics.
Your headquarters are in Attard, an old house in Attard, which has been beautifully restored, and it's a very bijou little museum environment, if you like, which to me is very attractive because it's, first of all, it's small enough to be able to go around and really take in everything, in the space of an hour. I think beyond an hour, most people's attention span starts to flag. The setting is very beautiful. It's in a row of lovely houses, Art Nouveau houses, so it's very much in keeping, and you've done a really good job in restoring it. And there's also the element that you can, to a certain extent, one can socialize even after seeing the exhibition, because there's a garden at the back, and that brings in the enjoyment element. You've seen all this beauty, and it's really nourished your sense of your aesthetic sense. But then it's time to talk about it with other people and discuss. Do you intend to do that?
Yes, have a glass of wine and enjoy it. You know, enjoy the Maltese garden.
You didn't answer my first question, though. The Storm Petrel Foundation. Why name it after a bird?
Okay, this came from one of the trustees who discussed it with us and said, listen, I'd like us to use something very Maltese as a name. Mm-hmm. Not in Maltese, because we want to, it's not because we didn't want to have it in Maltese, but because we wanted also to attract a very large audience. And in fact, we have connections even with other small museums abroad. And we have a great archivist, I must mention her, Romain Petrococchino, who does a fantastic job with the archiving and with connecting. And we have a setup which is very well used in very many small museums. So we're really, you know, capturing all the information we need, so we can have also, you know, people borrowing or using some of the images, etc., etc. So when we were looking for the name, we started coming up with all sorts of names, and somebody said, why don't we call it the Storm Petrel Foundation? And we said, why Storm Petrel? And they said, because it's a bird found in Malta. It's a very resilient bird. It's on the cliff. It's got a, you know, this is going to be a really difficult project to keep alive. This is really going to be a difficult thing to do, because who is going to come, you know, and pay to see an exhibition in such a small place, and you know, the collections of people who might have artifacts that are not usually found in the bigger museums. And so that's why we called it that.
On that note, I'm going to bid you all goodbye. And thank you so much, Bernie, for sharing your thoughts, your experience, your enjoyment, and your love for the arts with our audiences. I've loved it.
Bye. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.